We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
Many people have seen ghosts and reported incredible experiences from the realm of the spirit world. Who can tell what this young man will see as he falls deep into a trance?
Welcome to After Dark Radio and your host, Brian Alvarez.
Good evening, everybody. Brian Alvarez here. It is After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network, June 27, 2014. And what a show we have got tonight. I've been waiting for weeks and weeks to interview tonight's guest, David Politis, who has written a series of books, the Missing 411 series. I have right here in my hot little hands the Western United States and Canada edition of this book. This series is fascinating. I know that a lot of you out there probably enjoy a good hike here or there. I know that I live here in Washington State. As many of you are aware, a couple of months ago, my wife and I took a trip to the Grand Canyon, did a full day hike there, had a lot of fun. There's obviously a lot of different national parks around here in Washington State, lots of different places to go hiking. And of course, I live in pretty close proximity to Mount Rainier. And so I'm sure if you live anywhere near a mountain, every now and then you read the newspaper and you see the article, "Hikers Missing on Mount Rainier." And just actually a couple of weeks ago, a hiker disappeared, I believe, on Mount Rainier. And when you hear stories like this, many of you, including myself, prior to reading these books, just thought, okay, we're talking about the wilderness here. We're talking about climbing a mountain. We're talking about treacherous areas. Obviously, people are going to disappear. They're going to slip. They're going to fall. They're going to, unfortunately, pass away. This is just what happens when enough people go out in the woods. Bad things happen. Bad things happen. However, after reading this book, I was reading this book one night, and I don't live in a particularly rural area, but I do live in an area that is rural enough that there are deer all over the place around here. When I was a young child, there was a bear that ran through our yard. I know when you hear this, you think, my God, Brian must live out in the sticks. I don't. I live in Bothell, Washington. It is a suburb outside about 20 miles north of Seattle. And we got all of the amenities. Anyway, I got everything around here. But there are enough woods and streams and such, that right place, right time, you can see deer. So it's not a terribly rural area, but there is wildlife here. There are woods. And anyway, I was sitting on the couch reading this book, and I'm reading about all of these cases in Washington State of people that, you know, they walk out and they're gone. They disappear. And it's interesting because David, when he writes his book, it's called Missing 411. But in reality, most of the cases that he writes about in this book are individuals who disappeared and they are later found. Sometimes they are found alive. Oftentimes, only their body is found. Sometimes only parts of their body. And the point of this is, I'm reading about all these cases in Washington State, and suddenly I realized I had to go out to my car to get something. And my car, I live in a neighborhood. There are houses everywhere. I mean, there's certainly no, I mean, obviously there's no bears or anything around, but man, that trip from the front door to the car and back in the middle of reading missing 411, that was a long trip, let me tell you. And it was about 10 feet there and back. So when you read this book, you're going to read about people that have disappeared under very strange circumstances. Obviously, some of you listening will think, okay, you know, they fell. There was an animal attack. The strange thing is, however, David has I'm sure, gotten thousands and thousands of reports come across his desk. And he has whittled them down to originally 411. Now it's up around 1,200. But he excludes all cases where there is evidence of an animal attack. When an animal attacks somebody in the woods, there's signs of a struggle. There's all sorts of evidence, and a trained observer will be able to look at the aftermath and immediately just go, okay, animal attack. These are not situations. Any time there was an obvious animal attack, excluded from the book. Now, it is also interesting that and we'll talk a lot about this here tonight. These people disappear and strange things happen. For example, young children disappear. And they're found maybe 12, 14 hours later, and somehow they have traveled miles. We're talking two-year-old children that have supposedly traveled miles and miles and miles and miles over mountain ranges, over fences, sheer impossibilities. But somehow these children are found in these locations. We're going to talk about people who disappear and are found, but for some reason they are found without their clothes on. Their boots are gone. Their boots are never found. So many strange situations. We're going to talk about specific cases, and we're going to talk about some potential theories. So that is coming up later on tonight with David Politis. Now, I want to mention that this interview was taped earlier on this afternoon. I talked to David at about 2 o'clock this afternoon, and it was so fascinating because there was one case in particular that we were talking about that was a very recent case, and you're going to hear it when you listen to the interview. It is about a firefighter who disappeared recently. He was out. His dog ran off. This was in Arcadia, California. His dog ran off into the woods. He ran out after the dog, and he was never seen again. And this is not somebody with no outdoor experience. He had experience. He was a firefighter. He was a fitness enthusiast. Conditions were mild. It wasn't like a storm or snow or any. It was mild conditions, and he was gone. And at the time that we recorded the show, he had not been found. So I went to a wedding rehearsal dinner tonight, and in the middle of dinner, I got an email, and it was from David, and he said, "Brian, we discussed the case of the missing firefighter today during the interview. I stated that if he was found, he would likely be found at the bottom of a cliff. This was just released, and he sent me a news article. And sure enough, what does the news article say? A missing firefighter found. Body found. No indication of foul play. The body of Mike Herdman, the Arcadia firefighter who went missing in the Los Padres National Forest. There's another one. 2 weeks ago. He was found at 10 a.m. on Friday after being spotted by the air. And where was he found? 3/4 of a mile and 1,200 feet above the Sespe River bottom where he was last seen. No indication of foul play. The location of Herdman's body was below a cliff." Exactly as David Politis predicts on the show today before this news story came out. And you will notice, as you listen to the interview, that this individual was not the only one who got lost. And instead of, when getting lost, going down the mountain, for whatever reason, his body was found up the mountain. Why? We're going to talk about all of this on the program here tonight. Obviously, the After Dark Radio Show website, afterdarkradioshow.com. We've got a lot of great stuff up there. We may be taking some phone calls here, but I've got some very interesting stuff that I want to get into, so I will decide here in a moment. But if you would like to contact us during the show, you may do so through our Twitter. My handle is at Brian Alvarez. You can follow me on Twitter right now. I will be checking it out throughout the evening here. If you'd like to send me emails, you may do so to brian@wrestlingobserver.com. That is brian@wrestlingobserver.com, all one word. And make sure you put after dark in the subject line or the body of the email. And I will read any emails that we receive this evening on the program. And we may be taking phone calls after I get through with some of this news. I got a lot of stuff I want to get into here. We may be taking phone calls. Put this number in your phone. It is toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. The number is 855-478-4478. That is 855-478-4478. If we take phone calls, that is the number to call. And, of course, all of this information is available at the website afterdarkradioshow.com, as well as if you head up to the website afterdarkradioshow.com. Over there on the left-hand side of the page, in the news, the latest top stories from unexplained-mysteries.com, some of which we are going to be talking about on this program here tonight. And also, as always, up on the website, every evening, every Friday night when we conclude, the show that you are listening to right now goes up on the website as a free download where it remains for an entire week. And after that, it disappears, and you can only access the older shows as a subscriber to my main website, WrestlingObserver.com. So I'm telling you right now, if you have not heard the interview with Gary L. Stewart, who wrote the book The Most Dangerous Animal of All, Searching for My Father and Finding the Zodiac Killer, I suggest you go up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com right now, download the show. Gary L. Stewart believes and has a large amount of circumstantial evidence claiming that his father was, in fact, the Zodiac Killer. So if you would like to listen to that show, I suggest you head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com right now and check that out. Now, that is all the plugs, and I want to talk to you about something very interesting that I saw on one of my favorite websites, Anomalist, The Anomalist. Up at anomalist.com. First off, to set this up, if you go up to my website, afterdarkradioshow.com, and you scroll down there on the In the News area, you will see a very wacky story about a fox-human creature which is enthralling zoo visitors. You heard that right. Fox-human creature. So like a hybrid of a fox and a human is enthralling zoo visitors. So obviously, as soon as I saw that, I thought, well, this I got to see. So I clicked it. It takes me to the website here. And I shall read you part of this article. And then I'll tell you the point of this here. Fox-human creature enthralls zoo visitors. The bizarre spectacle of a half-fox, half-human has been attracting crowds to Karachi Zoo for years. Known as Mumtaz, the creature appears to possess the body of a fox and the head of a human that not only looks real, but can actually talk to zoo visitors when they go in to see it. Yes, it has the body of a fox, the head of a human, and it talks to people. Far from being a cryptozoological enigma, however, this bizarre crossbreed is nothing more than the body of a fox with a man's head sticking out from under a table to make it look as though it is part of the animal. 33-year-old Murad Ali is the man behind the myth and has been playing the character of Mumtaz at the zoo for up to 12 hours a day. He inherited the role from his father, who died 16 years ago. The people who visit here go away happy, he said. And knowing that they feel happy makes me happy too. There is a bond of love between me and them. Life is short. It should be spent spreading smiles. So if you go up to the website, you can see not only a photograph of this fox-human creature, but they've got a video. And what it is, the reason I bring this up at all, is They've taken what I presume is the stuffed body of a fox, and they've laid it on a table. That's the body. So then this fella here, Murad Ali, he goes under the table, and where there's obviously like a hole, and he sticks his head up through the hole, so it is the fox's body in his head. Now, how do they separate the head from the body, or how do they attach it, you ask? Well, you can't see the neck, because what they have done is they have taken like a red shawl of some sort, and they have wrapped the shawl around his neck. It covers like his head and like the back of his head and his neck. So essentially, what you see is the body of a fox. The fox appears to be wearing a shawl, and poking out of the shawl is this guy's head. The point of this is, in order to, I don't know if this has fooled a single person in the world, maybe some children, in order to attempt to fool you, in order to create the illusion of a fox body in a human head, they have taken to wrapping a shawl around so that you cannot see that, in fact, the head is not really connected to the body. This brings me to a very interesting, I don't know if you'd call it a study, but it is an essay. It is an essay from the Relict Hominoid Inquiry. Let me try that again. The Relict Hominoid Inquiry. This is also linked up at anomalous.com. It is an essay about, yes, the Patterson-Gimlin film. It is called, What Makes a Hoax Absolutely Genuine? This was written in 2012. It is a mini page. Let's see how many pages it is here. It is a 22-page analysis here of various attempts by Hollywood to recreate a Sasquatch for the movies or for television. There have been many attempts over the years. There was a Bigfoot on the $6 Million Man. There was Chewbacca, for example. There was Planet of the Apes. There were all sorts of movies. Harry and the Hendersons. Throughout the years, Hollywood has attempted to make apes or Sasquatch. And what this essay is about is, how well did Hollywood do when creating these Sasquatch? And is anything even close to as good as the Patterson-Gimlin footage, if one were to presume that the Patterson-Gimlin footage was faked? Now, if you go to anomalous.com, if you've not seen the Patterson-Gimlin footage for a while, there is a link to the latest attempt by a fellow named M.K. Davis to stabilize the Patterson-Gimlin footage. Right here, you can find it on YouTube as well. Patterson film with ultra-high background stabilization. He has taken 14 seconds of the film, he has put it through a filter, and he has stabilized this to the best of his ability. And you can watch this, and my only criticism really is that it has stretched it out to a different aspect ratio than it was originally filmed in. Originally, it was a square. Here, it has been stretched out. For example, if you've got like a widescreen television and you're watching an old movie that's filmed in a 4:3 ratio, it stretches it out to 16:9. So everything is a little bit wider in this particular stabilization here. But it's very, very smooth, and you can watch it. And it's very important that you watch this before you read this analysis of all of the other Bigfoots that have been created for the movies. He cites three ape-like attributes that are seen in the Patterson-Gimlin film, and he compares this to attributes that are used in making costumes for Hollywood. So, to cut to the chase, here's what he talks about. The first ape attribute is hair. Now, if you read this article, and actually I'm going to put this up on my Twitter right now, so you can head up to Bigfoot article I am talking about on After Dark. If you go up to at Brian Alvarez right now, that's my Twitter, you can follow along with what I'm talking about here. If you are reading this article here, you can scroll down to the bottom and you can check out a bunch of photos of the various Hollywood Bigfoot that we're talking about here. Figure one is a 7-foot Andre the Giant. There's a wrestling tie-in. Andre the Giant during the 2-part episode Secret of Bigfoot on the $6 Million Man. You can check that out. Below that is Peter Mayhew as Chewbacca, who I believe actually is coming back in the new Star Wars films that are in production right now. He's coming back as Chewbacca, I believe. Here is not a Bigfoot, but it is a giant from the day the Earth stood still. Below that is Kim Hunter in Planet of the Apes, Harry and the Hendersons, and a stunt actor with extendo arms that was used in Planet of the Apes, a remake in 2001, as well as some others as well, including Ted Cassidy, Ewoks, etc. These are all up here in this article. So as you look through the pictures, he points out that one of the main things, if you are creating a Bigfoot costume, which they have done many times in Hollywood, is you've got to hide the seams, because it's a costume. And so one of the main ways that they do this is hair that is of different lengths. So for example, if I'm making a Bigfoot costume and the hair all over the body of this costume is, say, 2 to 3 inches long, well, if I have to put the body on and then I've got a mask and I have to put the head on next, if all of the hair is 2 to 3 inches long, you're going to see a very visible seam around the neck where I put the head on. Also, if you had to slide into the legs or whatever, there's going to be seams everywhere. So how do they cover this up in Hollywood? Well, if you look at all these pictures, you will see that the easiest way to do this, and the most effective way, is you make the hair around the neck really long. So for example, you go down here and you look at all the photos, and there's Chewbacca. Look at the hair around the neck. It's much longer than the rest of the body, as well as the hair around the waist. Obviously, he had to slide on the pants of the costume. Then he put on the upper body, and to obscure the seam, they make all of this hair long around the waist. Well, you scroll down, and you essentially see this all over. Same thing with Harry and the Hendersons. Of course, he's got a long beard, and he's got this long hair all around his neck. So now you go back to the Patterson film, and what do you notice about the Patterson film? Well, the hair is 2 to 3 inches long, all over the body. There is no long hair around the neck. If you look in Hollywood, every single one of these costumes had long hair around the neck to obscure the seam. Now, even when we look at some of these here, for example, the Planet of the Apes here, we're talking CGI in 2001. There was no CGI in 1968. I believe it was 68, the Patterson-Gimlin film. 68, 69. There was none of that then. So you have to rule out CGI. So you're telling me that this costume that was created here, they did a better job with the hair length and hiding the seam than all of these other films, many of which were actually made right around the same time? So that's very interesting. Number two here, and it also points out that in the Day the Earth Stood Still, they had to make two costumes, because the first costume, they had a giant seam up the back. That's how you got into it. Well, obviously, the robot has to turn around, and so when they had to shoot it from the back, they made a second costume that the guy had to get in, which zipped up the front. And they had to keep cutting back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Well, if you watch the Patterson-Gimlin film, you see both sides of the Sasquatch, and you don't see anything resembling a seam up or down the back. So that's very interesting. Second here, long arms. It points out that the Patterson-Gimlin film, the arms of the Sasquatch are significantly longer than the arms of a person who would be that size. And so what do you have to do? Well, if you go to Hollywood, what they did is they created these arm extensions where you would essentially hold on to these arm prosthetics. And then you would sort of, that was how you extended the arms. And it points out that in King Kong in 1976, they had a man in a costume. And keep in mind, this was almost a decade after the Patterson-Gimlin film. And the prosthetic arms in King Kong did not look real, number one. Number two, they were stuck in one position. You could not operate the hands on these prosthetic arms. So they were not fists, nor were they completely open. They were half fists. And so whenever Kong had to pound his chest, he was essentially slapping his chest because the arms that they created, these prosthetic arms, couldn't make fists. And if you look at the Patterson-Gimlin film here, there are very, very long arms. The arms move. You can see the wrists move. You can see the hand move. And this would be extremely difficult to do if you put a man in a suit and gave him prosthetic arms. So this here would be further evidence. And finally, in addition to arms, ape attribute number three is width. Width. Whatever this thing was in the Patterson-Gimlin film, it was really big. It was really thick. And if you scroll down at all of these Bigfoot that were created for various Hollywood films, you will see many things in common. For those of you that are pro wrestling fans, I know there's tons of you listening right now. We're talking Andre the Giant. And granted, in 1976, he was skinnier than he was when he was wrestling Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 3. But still, a big giant dude. And by the way, it says here a 7'4" Andre the Giant. Andre, in fact, was only about 7 feet tall. The 7'4" was a fake pro wrestling height. But anyway, you can see Andre the Giant here. And when you compare the width of Andre the Giant as a man in this suit, and then you go back to the Patterson-Gimlin film, even the original film, which is not stretched out to 16'9", Patterson-Gimlin, Bigfoot, extremely wide as compared to Andre the Giant. Looks about twice as wide as Andre the Giant. You scroll down here to Chewbacca. Chewbacca looks positively emaciated as compared to the Sasquatch in the film. And all of the other Sasquatch here as well that you can look at. The closest we can come, really, to the same width is a... I guess you call it a Mugatu from Star Trek, which when you look at the picture of this, no way anyone in their right mind would think that that was anything except a man in a suit. That is the closest that anyone has come to coming even close to the width of whatever it is in the Patterson-Gimlin film. And I can't say 100% that I believe that whatever is in the Patterson-Gimlin film is a real Sasquatch. I can say that I have seen Bob Hieronymus, who has claimed to be the man in the suit. I have seen him in a monkey suit attempting to recreate the gait of this Sasquatch. And while he does do a decent job reproducing the gait of this Sasquatch, when you look at the size of Bob, the thickness and the width, as compared to whatever is in the Patterson-Gimlin film, it really jumps out at you that this dude is nowhere near as thick and stocky as whatever that was. And if you scroll down here and you look at the photos and you go one by one, here's Andre the Giant, here's Chewbacca, you go all the way down. They even have the Grinch from when the Grinch stole Christmas. And you go through all of these photos and finally down there at the very bottom, there is a still frame of the most famous frame of the Patterson-Gimlin film. It really is very striking that whatever that is, if that's a man in a costume, that is by far the best Bigfoot costume ever in history. And supposedly, it was made by two cowboys as a prank in October 20th, 1967. I got somebody who's been calling for a long time. Perhaps they're calling about this. You're on After Dark Radio. Who's this and where are you calling from?
Hey, Brian. This is Chris in Vegas.
Chris, what's up?
Hey, I hate to change the subject on you, but a couple weeks ago you had that guy who said he was the son of the Zodiac Killer.
Yes, I did. Last week.
And I wish I was home to call, but have you ever read Steve Hoddell's book?
What's it called? I probably have not, but what's it called?
He had also wrote a book on the Zodiac. I used to have that book. I think it was called Most Evil.
All right.
And he had linked the Zodiac Killer with the Black Dahlia in Chicago. and he was saying that was his father. And I was going to bring that up, but I didn't get a chance to call in.
Okay, it is, in fact, Steve Hodel, Most Evil, it is called. The Further Serial Murders of Dr. George Hodel. I guess it's Hodel. But regardless, yes, it appears he is claiming it is his father. And, let's see here. I'm just kind of looking through this deal here. It is up on Amazon.com, everybody, if you want to check it out. So he claims that his father was a Zodiac.
That's right.
And when you read the book, were you convinced?
I was very, very interested at that time. I haven't read the book in probably about 4 or 5 years. But I was like, really? But I was more confused how he was going back from Chicago to California to commit both crimes, because he was supposedly playing both parts, according to Steve.
Was he on Coast to Coast AM of late?
That I do not know.
Okay, somebody had told me that that somebody had been on Coast to Coast recently, claiming that they were essentially trying to tie in a number of murders, a number of famous serial killers. I think he was tying in to being one single guy, which kind of sounds like what you're talking about. If anybody is listening and knows what I'm talking about here, who I'm referring to, let me know, and I'll talk about it here on Twitter. So maybe I'll check that book out.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to go back and reread the book and then reread the new book, because it's been a long time.
Sure.
I want to bring it up, and then I'll have to call you on a different week and let you know what I think.
All right, well, call in with a book review.
All right.
Cool. All right, well, thanks so much for the call. I really appreciate it. All right, everybody. Again, if you want to check out the article I was just talking about regarding the analysis of the Patterson-Gimlin film, I have posted a link up on my Twitter. It is at Brian Alvarez. So head up there and check that out. And maybe give it a look over as you listen to the interview that's about to kick off with David Politis. And there is, in fact, somewhat of a tie-in, as we will talk about, a potential tie-in with the missing 411 cases here. So I want you to check it out if you can. Listen to the interview, and we will open up the phone lines in about 1 hour, immediately after the interview with David Politis. And so if you've got any comments on missing 411, if you've got any comments on this article here about the Patterson-Gimlin film, feel free to give us a call at 855-478-4478. I will also read any emails that come through my inbox, brian@wrestlingobserver.com, and make sure you put After Dark in the subject line. If you need any of the phone numbers, emails, Twitter handle, anything like that, the website for the show is afterdarkradioshow.com. So with that, in just a moment, we are going to be joined by David Politis. He is going to be talking about his series of books, Missing 411, Mysterious Disappearances in Our National Parks. Coming up here in just a moment, you're listening to After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. Here on After Dark Radio, Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio Show here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Very happy today to be joined by David Politis, talking the Missing 411 series. A series of books, actually. There's a West Coast version, there is an East Coast version, there is a new version out right now as well, talking strange disappearances in our national parks. And David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Brian. Thank you for having me.
You've got a new book coming out here. And very recently I was listening to some of your other interviews on the topic. I live here in Washington State. I've visited many national parks. I was reading the book. I decided to do so at night, which was a big mistake. I guess first off, the overarching theme of Missing 411. Tell everybody a little bit about what sort of first got you interested in the idea of missing persons in our national parks.
Initially, it got started when I was visiting a national park doing some peripheral research. I was talking to the contractors that worked there. I wasn't talking to the employees of the National Park Service. Spent a day there interviewing certain people. I noticed that there were a couple of park rangers that were sort of shadowing me in the park, and that's pretty normal. And I got back to my cabin, which was off the park's property, and early that evening, I get a knock at the door, and there's a couple of people there. They stated that, and they were dressed in plain clothes, they stated that they were national park rangers that were off duty, and they wanted to talk to me. And that doesn't happen very much, and I said, absolutely, come on in. And that started a conversation about their careers and about what they saw during those fairly lengthy careers about missing people. And each of them independently didn't know each other before they came to this one park, but they had worked at several parks each. And they had seen a series of disappearances of people. And on the front end, there was a lot of publicity and there was a lot of effort to find the people. Then after that 7 to 10 day cycle, everything stopped. And there was no more publicity, there was no more searching, there was no more follow-up, there was no more nothing. And when they, as employees, tried to find out what the status was, they were somewhat steamrolled by their own system, and they thought that something was really wrong. Number one, there was an inordinate amount of people disappearing in places that they shouldn't have been disappearing in and shouldn't have been in. And then there was an inordinate amount of inaction on the part of the Park Service in trying to find the people in any subsequent follow-up. And they said that they knew about my investigative background, and they wanted somebody to look into this because they thought it was a worthy story. This was a lengthy conversation. They ended up leaving, and the next morning I took off. I was heading home, called a couple of friends in law enforcement, told them the story, and I said, hey, start checking missing persons databases and some archives and see if you can find anything on this. Within a couple hours, I get a call back saying, wow, there are a lot of people disappearing in these parks, and this looks like it's something worth investigating. And that's kind of how it all got started.
You know, obviously we've gotten Mount Rainier here, and every now and then you hear, okay, these guys were hiking, they disappeared. And you know, prior to really reading your book here, I've got the Western States and in Canada version right here in front of me. You know, I, as a layman, I hear, okay, some guys went up Mount Rainier and this person disappeared. And so you immediately assume, you know, he fell. Something perfectly natural happened to this person. He just, you know, things happen when you're climbing Mount Rainier. I never really thought about, I never was aware that this is a very dark topic. I guess first off, let's talk about what you consider a case that would be open for inclusion in your book. Obviously, we're not talking about just a guy goes up and disappears. There have to be a certain number of circumstances surrounding it. There are a lot of strange things that are in common. One, for example, is berries are often involved. Talk a little bit about some of the things that merit inclusion in your books.
Well, this is a very timely call, Brian, because there was a woman that was described by her employees and her peers as the guru of the trails, and the last person they'd ever expect to disappear on a trail happened in your backyard on Mount Rainier, June 18th of this year.
That's right. Just happened.
So this phone call is going to hit on a very timely issue. 70 years old, she was an outdoor writer and a marathon runner in phenomenal shape. Actually wrote articles about trail safety. And she went up with a friend, and they were in the northeast sector of the park at about 5,000 feet, and they were on the OWYHIGH Lakes Trail, Owyhi Trail. And as they were about to reach the snow, they took a break. The friend said that he was going to hold on right there because they were about to encounter snow, and she said she was just going to go ahead just a bit. Early articles stated that the friend told searchers that he didn't think she was going to go far because snow was going to hit them, and that's why they did stop, and he thought she was going to be right back. Well, she didn't come right back. And at 10:30 that night, he hiked out, called search and rescue, and the effort started to find her. Now, If her friends and her as herself claim to be an expert on trails, she hikes 2 times a week, she knows Mount Rainier like the back of her hands. Predominant climbers and people in that area said in numerous articles she would be the last person to disappear on any trail. She disappears for 3 days. And Park Service found her in an area that was up approximately 750 feet in elevation to a top of a ridgeline. That would be going east. Then she went back down the other side of that into an area near Boundary Creek, meaning that when she was at the top of this ridge, she could look down into the valley she just came from and knew where she just was at. Yet she's going in the exact opposite direction where she'd be, into deeper and deeper snow and rougher terrain. It makes zero sense. The Park Service, quote them, says, she was found in an area difficult to access and not commonly traveled. Now, they found her, and she was supposedly left her friend carrying a backpack with emergency gear inside to survive a night in the climate. Yet she died supposedly of hypothermia, which is common in the cases that we cite. There is nothing about this case that reeks of normality. It reeks of absolute abnormality.
You've got thousands of cases in these books, and we're going to go over a few specific cases here in a while. But looking again at the overarching theme, one thing that is, I mean, there's a million strange things, but one of the things that is very strange you just mentioned in that particular case is there are a lot of people that, for some reason, they should know better, but they're found thousands of feet up from wherever they disappeared. Now, I don't know much about, I'm not a real outdoorsman like the Lady of the Trails or anything of that nature, but I would think that if I were lost somewhere, my natural reaction would be to start going down as opposed to going up. I mean, maybe I'm completely out of my mind, but I would be thinking that, okay, if it's cold, I'm going to go up, it's going to be even more cold, plus I'm going up and nobody knows where I'm at, so I should go down. But for whatever reason, these people are found, in many cases, up. And I don't know why. It makes no sense to me.
Well, let's think about Karen's case for a second. She was supposed to be right back, according to her friend, because they were coming up to snow on the trail. That's the reason he stopped. Now, not only does she supposedly keep going, she supposedly keeps going up 750 feet higher in elevation into deeper snow, into colder conditions, into an area that is off trail, not commonly went to, and is very rugged. Now, she was a very smart person in phenomenal shape. She knew Mount Rainier like the back of her hand. There's no rational reason or explanation for what happened there. And it's another one of the things that I talk about in many of my books. In fact, Roger Marsh wrote an article in the Huffington Post. The title of the article was "Don't Be Last in Line." On the opposite end of the scale, don't be first in line. Meaning, when you're on the trail with somebody, it seems like an inordinate amount of time in the stories we have found. If you're the last one in line and we can't see you, you're the one that's going to be disappearing.
That's right.
If you're the first in line off alone, you're going to be the one that's going to disappear, as in Karen's case. And as many people have remarked, it almost seems as though something is monitoring us on these trails. And when opportunity presents itself that you're alone, that's the time you're gone.
Let's talk a little bit about the Corey Fay case. For all of you listening right now, I am being somewhat selfish today in choosing cases because I do live here in Washington, and obviously there are cases all over the country. I've looked through and chosen some from around here because I know a lot of these areas. And B, a lot of these show similarities to other cases. This Corey Fay case, there are cases in Montana, in the Yukon, that are all very, very similar to this. An individual disappears. He's found 3,000 feet higher in elevation. He actually was not found. A portion of him was found. I'll go ahead and let you give some of the details here, and then we'll talk more about it.
So it happened November 23rd, 1991. the Teague Valley right on the Washington border in the Badger Wilderness in Oregon. Corey was a junior in high school, 17 years old. He carried an emergency solar blanket, a compass, food, ammunition, a small backpack, and a rifle when he was hunting. Three of his buddies and he went into an area, parked, and they split up, and they were supposed to come back at 6:30. They were looking for elk. And this was a known hot spot for elk. Well, Corey never came back to the car. Nobody saw an elk that day. And the subsequent search included 250 searchers for 10 days covering 12 square miles. And during this time, the theory initially was that another hunter killed him and then buried him. So on December 1st, the search was terminated. Fast forward to September, and September 12th. Hunters were 10 miles from the point Corey was last seen. They weren't looking for him, but they find his backpack and his rifle on a ridge. And they also found his jacket a mile away on the same ridge. And one quarter a mile away from his backpack, in a subsequent search, they found one tooth and bone fragments. Now, unless you've read thousands of cases, and unless you've spent years doing this, this really means very little. But this is really key, because Corey was found 3,000 feet up, higher in elevation than where he should have been hunting. They never found his boots, his pants, or socks. Very, very unusual, because when you talk about search and rescue and deputies that work the backcountry, shoes are always found, because there's something that doesn't deteriorate in the wild like clothes does. But they never found his boots. And that's one thing that we find in many of these cases. People disappear, and their shoes are never found. And if they are found, the shoes are nowhere near them. Now, in Corey's case, they found one tooth and bone fragments. In a phenomenal set of coincidences, there was a boy named Jared Atadero that disappeared in Colorado. He was found 4 years later, found 550 feet higher in elevation on a trail, almost up a cliff from where he disappeared, and they found one tooth, bone fragments, and a skull cap. One tooth again. How difficult is it to find one tooth? It's very difficult. When you consider that you have femur, that's your leg bone, you got hip bones, these things should have been found. And again, an analysis, and people could think, okay, well, maybe animals took it away. Well, maybe that's possible. But how did Corey, who's 17 years old and was trained by his grandparents and his father to go downhill if you're lost or you're missing, Corey goes uphill 3,000 feet into worse weather, into horrible snow conditions. It makes no sense.
Now, what is also interesting about that case that you mentioned is they found his backpack and some other belongings, and then a mile away they found his jacket. Now, we don't really know, because they didn't find really, you know, as you noted, they didn't find his boots, they didn't find most of him, but one could perhaps conclude that it seemed like he was slowly taking things off as he traveled. Again, we don't know this, but if you look at a lot of the cases in the book, you do find that as people are disappearing, they appear to be taking their clothes off.
See, I don't think that's the case, and I don't think that you could use that analysis on this, because if he was cold and he was hypothermic, he was carrying a backpack that had a solar blanket in it. He had food. He had survival gear, and he was trained in survival. So I don't believe that's what happened here. Now, maybe in some other instances it did. I've had other people tell me, well, it's obviously he was attacked and dragged away by an animal. Well, the problem with that is predatory animals on November 23rd, bears and things, they're hibernating. They're not going to be around. There may be a mountain lion, but there was no blood found on any of his clothes.
That's my other question. I mean, were there any details about the state of his jacket? I mean, was it scratched up? Was it ripped up? Or was it just laying there?
There was no evidence of an animal attack, according to the sheriffs. And they would put that in their reports if there was, and there was none.
Now, in many of the other cases, in fact, one of them that we're going to talk about here, I believe Daryl, children, especially in Washington, it's very strange. There are some trends in Washington. There are a number of short, skinny girls that have disappeared in Washington State, but there have been zero girls under 10 who have vanished. There have been several boys under 10, and in some of these cases, when they find the body, they are horribly scratched up. Now, one would conclude that if somebody investigating this saw all of these scratches, they would be immediately able to say, okay, it was some sort of big cat, it was some sort of, you know, who knows what, some sort of animal attack. But the fact that you put it in the book suggests that that was not what was concluded about the scratches. Is that correct?
It's never been assumed in any of the cases that an animal attack. In fact, in each of the cases in the book, that has been one of the issues that was cleared. We won't work a case and we won't include a case if there's any evidence of an animal attack, if there's any evidence of mental illness, if there's any evidence of drowning. Those are three of the exclusionary issues we have. And if search and rescue says, nope, no evidence of an animal attack, then we'll look at it.
Keith Parkins disappeared from Ritter, Oregon. He was 2 years old. And this case is interesting because when you're a two-year-old child, usually you've just learned to walk. And in this case, and in a lot of cases in the book, we're talking a two-year-old child who is later found, 12 miles away he was found, I believe. Tell us the story of Keith Parkins.
Well, one of the things I do when I'm talking to a group of people is I ask the group how many people in the audience have kids. And usually it's two-thirds or three-quarters of the adults there raise their hands. And I ask them, so at 2 years old, how far would your child, if they were walking in the woods, how far could they walk away? And most of them laugh and say, oh, my kid wouldn't walk hardly at all. They'd just sit down and cry. Others of them said, well, you know, they may walk downhill for 5 or 10 minutes, get tired, roll over and go to sleep. None of them said that a two-year-old would walk uphill. None of them said that their two-year-old would walk more than 2 miles. And if you look at search and rescue manuals, 99% of the time, a two-year-old found in a region of 2 miles or less from the point they're last seen. In Parkins' case, he was visiting his grandparents' home, and it was a farm in the northeast corner of Oregon. Now, what's important about this is, again, after researching 1,200 cases, a lot of these kids are disappearing in the presence of aunts, uncles, and grandparents. And it's almost as though someone else is watching them when this is happening. And in Parkins, he's visiting the grandparents. He's walking around their ranch. He disappears. And big search starts right away. And 19 hours later, in the wee hours of the early morning hours of the following day, his dad and another searcher are walking along a creek bed, two mountain ranges away, several creeks and rivers, several barbed wire fence lines, and they find him face down in this dry creek bed, unconscious. They take him to a hospital. He survives. Now, as all of us, the researchers and I, are going over this case, yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal that he's found 12 miles away in 19 hours. None of us could believe it, but that was the truth. But what's equally unbelievable is there isn't any search and rescue professional in this world that would tell anybody to go set up 12 miles away 19 hours after a two-year-old disappears and start looking there. That's pure stupidity. So why his dad and another searcher are at this distance in that time frame is perplexing at best.
Did you ever conclude that perhaps his and really, the more I think about this, I mean, as I say it, it sounds ridiculous, but I mean, the only thing that one could conclude in a case like that is his father was responsible or something, and that's why, you know, he's like, oh, you know, we found him here or whatever. But again, it doesn't make any sense because the whole thing is just ridiculous. If the father was responsible, why would he claim that he found the child so far away? It makes no sense. Everything about this makes no sense.
So again, we've kicked this around a lot. And he was in the presence of other searchers when he found his son. So it's not like he could have dropped them off there. And
sure.
You know, again, like you said, it makes no sense. Except that if the grandparents lived on this rural ranch, they know if unusual things are happening around that ranch. And maybe they knew something out of this normality was happening around there. And they tell them, hey, you start searching that direction and you keep heading that way and don't stop. I have no idea, but it's obvious they had some kind of inside information on something. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been there.
Now, you mentioned on the topic of that, I mean, it's not relevant in this particular case, but when you talk about strange, I'll just spit it out. Devils, something or other. Devils, peak devils, mountain devils. I mean, things seem to happen in areas that have foreboding names, as if the individuals that named these places had known that in the past strange things happened here.
Well, and again, I don't want to take up a lot of your time and distract from the issues in Washington, but as we're speaking, there's a Arcadia firefighter in Southern California, a guy named Mike Herdman, 36 years old, that went backpacking with a friend up in rural Ventura County in the Los Padres National Forest, June 13th. And they hiked way into the woods, started to set up camp. And Mike brought his dog with him, and the dog, as they're setting up camp, the dog takes off running into the woods. Well, Mike was barefoot, wearing shorts and a T-shirt, and he takes off running after the dog. Well, his buddy, a guy named Tyler Byers, who's also a firefighter paramedic, couldn't believe what he just saw, and he's just yelling and waiting, and Mike never comes back. The dog never comes back. Tyler waits the night, comes back, decides to hike out the next morning and get help. And, you know, the cavalry arrives and they start searching, and they've been searching since. On Sunday, June 22nd, Mike's dog, a dog named Duke, shows up at the trailhead where everyone's searching. Just shows up there. Well, I get a note a few days ago from somebody saying to look at this website. And it's a website that was developed in 2011 on the area in the Sespe Wilderness where Mike disappeared. So the name of my latest book is called Missing 411, The Devil's in the Detail.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that you got to look at the detail, and I'm talking about specific detail points in these missing persons cases to understand what's going on. And it has a double meaning. Also, a lot of people disappear in these areas, just like you said, that have geographical names with devil in them. Well, a person who read my book points me to this site, and it's a site with a lot of pictures and things about the Sespe Wilderness. And the title of this website is The Devil's in the Detail.
About that.
I almost fell out of my chair. And it cites Devil's Heart Peak, Devil's Gateway, Devil's Potrero, all in the Sespe Wilderness, all in the area of the Condor Sanctuary, all in the area that these two firefighters were in. Now, as of today, Herdman still hasn't been found. They've thrown every resource at it that you can imagine. It fits the profile to what I've written about for the last 5 years. Namely, you're with somebody, you take off alone, and you go missing with a canine. And there's another key point. He left with his dog.
Mm-hmm.
The other point being is that they brought in canines to search, and they never found his scent. Another key point that I write about in these books. In all of these cases, there's no scent that could be found by tracking dogs. They throw FLIR in helicopters and planes searching the area. There's no heat signature of Mike anywhere. Now, if you look back on the history of these cases, Herdman, if he's going to be found, he's going to be found in an area that was searched many times before, and he might be at the bottom of a cliff or in a very rough and rugged area, and it's going to appear that he fell to his death. If it follows as all of the rest of the cases that we've researched, these 1,200, that's the way Herdman will be found. I hope he's found alive, but at this point, I doubt it.
You know, I had seen that, I think, 2 days ago. And it was like, ah, what a coincidence. We've got David on the show on Friday. How about that? I was actually wondering if it fit the profile, because at the time, the update that I had read was that, you know, he'd gone running after the dog and they didn't find him, but they had found the dog. And so I didn't know if there were other details to it. But now that you mentioned the devil in the details, very fascinating. You know, you mentioned dogs, and no particular case here, but since you mentioned it, the overarching theme is that not only, I mean, it appears that sometimes the dogs won't follow a scent, and I know you had one case where the dog did follow the scent all the way to a fork in the road, and then it just stopped. Sometimes the dogs want nothing to do with it. You try to get them to follow a scent, and they're just like, they're not moving. I mean, it's very bizarre behavior, and when you have talked to search and rescue people, I mean, have they kind of told you, like, we've never seen anything like this before? This dog searches for anything. We have no idea why this is happening.
So 2 years ago, I gave a talk on this in front of the biggest search and rescue organization in the world. It's called NASAR, National Association of Search and Rescue. They had their annual conference in Lake Tahoe. And nobody knew who I was, and I didn't come with any search and rescue specific ability other than we'd been researching cases for years. And it was a packed room at the end. Everyone just about stayed and wanted to talk. And what they said was, Dave, you're talking about things we all know. We all know are happening, but nobody wants to talk about it. And specifically, there were a couple of Alaska state troopers that were there, and they said, hey, this happens all the time in Alaska. And boy, since that point, I can tell you that is a fact. There's a lot of these missing person cases in Alaska, but they're all over as well. And you know, you never hear much about it from the press, because and I don't blame them, because after a while, everyone kind of gets, I don't know, hardened to the fact that all people should disappear, and if they go missing, then it's just normal not to find them. That is completely not true. We should be finding, seriously, 100% of the people who go missing who want to be found. Now, it's different when somebody goes into the wilderness and is suicidal. Again, we won't search those cases and we won't work those cases, but those people, if they don't want to be found, you may not ever find them. But an involuntary disappearance where somebody, a small child specifically, disappears, we should be finding them every time.
And when we talk about, okay, let's say somebody goes into the woods and they're attacked by an animal and devoured. I mean, in that case, you should still find, for example here, boots, which for whatever reason, usually you don't find boots.
Well, if somebody's attacked by an animal, you're going to find a scene there of an attack. You're going to find hair. You're going to find bits of clothing. You're going to find a lot of blood. You're going to find drag marks where the person's drug away. It's going to be obvious, and search and rescue knows what they're looking for on these incidents. And when search and rescue goes in, 9 times out of 10, they're also bringing a professional tracker in with them. The tracker's looking for those specific highlights you mentioned, along with predatorial marks in the area of things that may be of danger to you and I.
Now, missing 411, was that name originally because he had 411 cases?
That again, was a bit of a play on words. True. In both books that initially came out almost simultaneously, there were 411 cases. But 411, when you think about it, when you dial 411, you're getting information.
Sure.
The reality of it is that there's a complete lack of information on this topic until we started to come out with it. The truth is that most of the big governmental agencies don't want to talk about this. They don't want to give us information. They want to restrict the public access to the information, and they don't want you to know the numbers of people that have disappeared in the number of years from specific areas.
Now, in your book, you have talked about the battles that you have had with the Forest Service. In the sense that one would think, when I think about national parks, at least until I read your book, it was very positive. You know, you got these national parks, you've got these park rangers, there are these nice trails. You know, it's a fun, pleasant experience. And I would have thought at the time that, okay, if there have been some people that have disappeared in this park, you know, I'm sure it has been investigated, I'm sure they've tried to find them, and I would think that they would have a database of this. And tell everybody a little bit about the experiences that you have had when you have tried to contact them about getting a list of people who have disappeared in these parks.
So first of all, the people you see in the national parks, the rangers that greet you, the people on the trail, they're phenomenal individuals. They know nothing about what you and I are talking about. They're doing a job they love to do, and they're doing a great job. And I have nothing but positive things to say about them. Absolutely, this is the truth. The policies that the National Park Service has and the Department of the Interior has are of trouble, major trouble. When we first started, we knew that the National Park Service covers 183 different locations. And if our initial stats proved to be true, which they are true, then a lot of missing people are centered on these national parks. So we have the Freedom of Information Act that the government says that a U.S. citizen has a right to public documents if they don't compromise national security, and these should be accessible to us for reasonable fees, copying fees, clerical fees, etc. So we sent the National Park Service a Freedom of Information Act request for a list of missing people from their system. About 4 or 5 months later, I got a call from an attorney from the National Park Service asking why I wanted that information. According to the Freedom of Information Act, that is not a question that can be asked by any government agency and used on as a decision maker on whether you get that material or not. So I asked him, I said, why does that matter? I mean, I'm interested in the number of missing people. And he says, well, we don't have any of that information. I said, well, maybe I need to rewrite my request because maybe it's a semantics issue, but we're interested in a list of the missing people in each one of the parks or a cumulative list of all the missing people from your system for the last 80, 90 years. And he said, no, you don't understand. We don't keep any of that information. I said, no, wait a minute. Every small and medium-sized police department, let alone every large police department in North America, has a list of missing people, sometimes on their website, but guaranteed in the offices, and it's information that's tracked, and commanders look at it monthly. It's an important, politically sensitive issue. I said, you guys got to have that. He says, no, we don't track that information. I said, okay, well, I have a couple of books in print, and I want to claim an author's exemption, and I want that information. And there's a abstract part of the Freedom of Information Act that says that if you're a published author, then you could ask for an exemption on all fees to get information because you're going to write about it and make it publicly available. He goes, well, we've already looked into that, and your books aren't in enough libraries to qualify.
I find that hard to believe, that is a requirement.
Oh, we looked hard, and we can't find it in any of the Freedom of Information Act documents. I said, where did you get that? I said, I've never heard of this. He says, oh, that's our internal policy. I said, well, how many libraries do I have to be in? He goes, well, that's an internal decision that we make that on the spot. So obviously that's some sliding scale that you and I will never understand.
It'd be about a billion libraries, I suspect.
Must be. So I said, well, okay, then I want the documents anyhow, so tell me how much it's going to cost. So he says, okay, we'll get back to you. So at the same time, I said, well, I also want a list specifically for Yosemite, because at the time it appeared Yosemite had a phenomenal number of people that have disappeared there. So about 3 months later, I get an email back, and it says, well, if you want the list from Yosemite alone, it's going to cost you $34,000. That's a lot of money. And if you want it from the entire national park system, that's going to be $1.4 million. So after we caught our breath and realized they obviously don't want us to have that information, then we're going to have to go the long route and do the best we can at putting people down and finding out how many are actually missing to the best we know by digging through archives and spending a lot of hours. And since that time, the most unwielding thing they've done to us is a park ranger disappeared in Rocky Mountain National Park, a guy named Jeff Christensen. Mm-hmm. And I won't go into the details of his disappearance, but there are five or six phenomenally unusual parts to that disappearance. He was found deceased. Park Service searched for him for 7 days. They didn't find him. Some other citizen found him after the search was over. And this Park Service brought in a special crew of investigators to look into that case. And I filed a Freedom of Information Act, and they got back to me, and they said, well, you can't have it right now because we're going to have to review it and redact it. So if you want a copy of that report, it's going to cost you $7,200 in review fees.
Now, before we get into the review fees, first off, why would it need to be redacted?
So they can protect the privacy of certain individuals listed in the report.
After they're deceased?
Well, now you bring up another good point. I'll try to make this short. Two women disappeared in Craters of the Moon National Monument earlier this year. And these were large women. And they left their dogs in their truck. They disappear. And their family said they're never going to walk further than a couple hundred yards from the truck. They're never going to leave their dogs more than an hour. Make a very long story short, they're found miles into this crater, lava rock infested area that has rocks that are sharp and dangerous. One's found after a week, another's found after a month. Nobody can figure out how they got there or what they were doing there. And the Park Service won't furnish anything other than a wanted poster on the people saying that they have to protect the privacy of the relatives. Not the privacy of the people, they're dead. The privacy of the relatives.
Why? I don't want to sound like I'm flippant about it, but it just seems like what are you protecting them from? That an individual got lost or disappeared? I mean, I don't understand what their justification is for this.
Well, the only thing we can think is that they must have been found without clothing on, which fits the profile.
It does fit the profile, yeah.
And that would be embarrassing to family members. That's the only thing we can think of.
Now, actually, let's do a case here, and then we'll continue on. Tell me about Daryl Webley.
So Daryl, another 2 years old, April 30th, 1949. We're going to go back a while at 4 p.m. He's playing in his yard in Colville, Washington. If people don't know Colville, there's an Indian reservation right there as well. And over the years, there's been a lot of strange things that have happened in the reservation, all the way from strange lights in the sky over an extended period of time, weird sounds in the woods, etc. Anyhow, he's playing at his house. He disappears. The sheriff brings in canines, and they search. They search 2 miles out in every direction. They look everywhere. They can't find anything. 5:30 in the morning, the following morning, they start again. And one of the dogs turns around and runs 1 mile in a ravine away from the house in an area that was searched the night before. And they find the boy's cap, his pants, and one shoe. And then 30 minutes later, up the same canyon, the boy's found alive. And I'm saying up the canyon, we're going uphill, 2 years old. So in total, he's missed 14 hours. The temperatures that night were down to 35 degrees. And he's missing clothing, he's missing shoes, he's uphill, and he's quite a distance from his house. Very unusual circumstances for a little two-year-old.
Now, he was alive, so is there any information about what he said happened to him?
In most of these cases, if the people are found alive, they're at an age where they either can't explain or won't explain what happened. In this case, there was no explanation, no conversation that was ever mentioned in any of the articles. Other times, with two-year-olds, they say that the boy didn't want to talk, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it's just dropped. You got to understand the mindset of the sheriffs and search and rescue teams. First of all, 95% of all search and rescue is done by volunteers. Mm-hmm. People just like you and me with special training who want to spend their spare time saving people. God bless them, because without them, it never happened. So when they go out there, they're not thinking criminal intent. They're not thinking abduction. They're not thinking unusual circumstances. They're just doing their job. and probably a very, very small percentage of all search and rescue have ever heard of my books. So even though the circumstances might be unusual, they're going to just slough it off, and they're going to think, okay, well, you know, this kid was one of those phenomenal kids that went uphill 2 miles, and we found him. God bless him. He's alive. Let's go.
Sure.
Back home. And then the sheriff, if they get involved, unless there's some sexual molestation, I doubt there's anything that's going to be done. And in none of the cases that we've researched has there been any sexual molestation of the child.
You know, the reason I brought up 411 earlier, the number 411, is because I don't know this, but my assumption is that of all of the cases that come across your desk, we're probably talking thousands of cases, and you have whittled them down, so to speak, to, I guess, it's about, what, 1,200 now among all the books? I would presume that, you know, significantly more come in than the number that you actually look at all of the details and go, okay, you know, this is one that fits the profile, so to speak.
Correct.
This is probably going to sound to some people listening to this like the stupidest question I may have ever asked on this program. But when you look at the number of small children that disappear and are found so far away, oftentimes up, if you really use your imagination and you don't care about asking a stupid question, you could ask, is it possible that they were picked up by a large bird?
And in the early years, in the 40s and the 50s, when you read about cases, that's an explanation that's sometimes brought up as a possibility. But if, let's just say, a small 2-year-old or 2.5-year-old is picked up by a bird and carried away, I think that kid may scream or yell or cry.
Sure.
And that's never heard.
So this is, and actually we'll get into another case here in a moment, but we're talking like mom, dad, whoever, they are gone for a moment, and they return, and the child is gone. No sound.
The only time that there has been a sound is on a case that we'll talk about in a little bit, Keith Parkins, but he was inside of a camper.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm talking about kids that disappear on a trail. The parents say, you know, the kid was right behind me, right next to me. I turned around, and they're gone. They didn't hear a sound. There's nothing.
Let's talk about Keith right now. This is a case where, on the surface, because there was like a scream and it did take place in a camper, I mean, a person could maybe conclude that this was just your typical abduction, but you have included it in the book, and so you are looking at this as a mysterious case.
Okay, so it was my mistake. It's Jimmy Duffy.
Jimmy Duffy, sorry.
So, this was October 19th, 1973, about 2:15 in the afternoon. They were in a location called Little Wenatchee Ridge near Wenatchee Lake in Washington. Parents are Jim and Carol Duffy. Jim was up there hunting. They parked their pickup truck and camper on the ridge line. And Jimmy was 2 years old, and he had a little sister named Natalie that was a little smaller than he. Jimmy was put in the camper to take a nap. Natalie was asleep, and they had a cat inside the camper that was all asleep. And so all of them are inside this camper sleeping, and Jim and Carol were taking a walk around the perimeter of the camper, just walking around. They're about 150 yards away. They were looking at the camper, and momentarily they walk behind some trees, and they hear a scream. They run back just seconds later, and they see the camper door open. So they run up to the camper, and this is the part that is very bizarre. So imagine how loud of a scream it has to be coming from a little boy to be heard 150 yards away. It has to be pretty loud. So they get to the camper, and they look inside, and Natalie and the cat are still asleep inside the camper, but Jimmy's gone. And they start searching, and they... smart, they start looking in the dirt, and they're not seeing any tracks. And that's a big deal. So the sheriffs get called. Now, one thing is, that is not in any of the law enforcement reports that I read, and I got the original reports, it doesn't say whether Jimmy had his shoes on or not when he was taking a nap. And other people in other articles indicated that Jimmy was very frail, almost to the point of being disabled. which is another common trait of many of the kids that disappear that we write about, and adults, that they have some type of serious disability. So anyhow, Jimmy disappears, sheriffs get there, and right away they start accusing Jim and Carol of some type of collusion in the disappearance. And, I mean, they essentially called him up front and said, hey, we think you might have killed your boy, blah, blah, blah. I mean, some real daring things to say to parents that just lost their child. So at 11:30 a.m. the following morning, Chelan County, or Halen, or however you pronounce it, made a decision to terminate the search. So they just stopped after less than 24 hours. So detectives on the case decide that they're going to put Jim and Carol on a polygraph and see if they're telling the truth. And so they sent them to Seattle to really good polygraph people, and they passed, both of them. They didn't know what caused their son's disappearance. They didn't know where their son was at. They were completely cleared. So when I called on this case about a year and a half ago, we did it through an archival search. That's how we found it. And the county sheriff didn't have any record of this case. None. And if it wasn't for a clerk working in the sheriff's office that took a personal interest in this and hunted for weeks, she found the microfiche and rebuilt the case and sent us all the reports. And now it's back on record as a real case, as a real disappearance. Otherwise, you'd never even hear about this. Now, let's think about this on rational terms. The county brought in canines trying to pick up Jimmy's scent. They didn't find any. They didn't see any tracks. The parents hear a scream. The kid's gone. Now, how can that boy scream and not wake up the cat that's next to him in this camper or his sister? That's question number
one. Well, I don't have kids, but I've got three cats, and I'm stunned.
Yeah. That's number one. But number two, when you start looking at this area of Washington around Wenatchee, you start to realize that over the years, there's been a lot of really, really weird things and strange disappearances that have happened that cannot be explained. And when you look at Washington wilderness as a whole, you'll realize that young boys have been disappearing from this area for decades.
Mm-hmm. I knew when we scheduled this interview that there is absolutely no way we have enough time to ask all of my questions, which is why I sent you a limited number of cases. But I've got two topics that we've got to discuss before we wrap it up. The first is perhaps you could call the elephant in the room in the sense that you have worked a lot on research into Bigfoot. And you don't make any conclusions. I mean, the book is a series of cases, and you comment on a lot of the cases, but it's not like you had a hypothesis of any sort going in and you're trying to fit the facts to whatever the hypothesis is. All you are doing is, here are the cases, here's what happened, this is the story. But obviously, I would presume that there are people that because this is happening in the forest, because this is happening in the woods, because this often happens when people are hunting elk. And obviously there are theories that a Sasquatch would eat elk. Because things happen involving berries, and there is a theory that perhaps these creatures eat berries. And even perhaps because there have been cases where I know one child claimed that I believe when she was gone, I believe it was a girl, she had essentially been, I don't know if babysat is the right word, but a wolf had taken care of her when she was gone. So a person could tie all of this together and build a theory around maybe this has to do with Sasquatch. Now, is there anything about this that you would be interested in discussing?
So last month I came out with our latest book, Missing 411, The Devil's in the Detail. And in that book, there are a series of strange disappearances and factors that we've learned about in the last year that we didn't know about years ago. But one thing as a good researcher, you keep an open mind and you don't make statements that you can't back up with facts, even circumstantial facts. And one of the things we've steered clear of over the last 5 years is pointing a finger and saying, this is what's happening. The reason being is, as the years go on, you learn more and more and more. A guy in Finland happened to read the books, and for the last 2 years he's been working, and he confirmed that five people that we've documented that have disappeared in the U.S. in the last 100 years, five people have disappeared the same day as one of 125 planes that have disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle. Now, initially, your mind goes, ah, so what? If you look at the statistical possibilities of that, it's phenomenal. It's so low, you would never think it could be rationally thought about occurring. It has. The other thing is that in the book, we stick to the profile that we established at the beginning. And in that profile, even under the most narrow conditions, there's three people that were on a fishing raft off of Everglades National Park, and a large yacht was watching them. And within minutes, a storm comes in, envelops the area, washes these guys into a cove where there's water 2 feet deep. The big yacht loses sight of them. The water's so low here, they could get out and walk to shore. These guys disappear, are never found again, on an island setting in a national park. And this is, so we're talking about aerial issues. We're talking about water disappearances. And then we kept pushing on the aerial side, and we documented that of the incidents that we've already documented in the books, four times where a search and rescue helicopter or plane was searching for people we've identified, those planes or those helicopters crashed and killed people.
Hmm.
How phenomenally minimal chances of this kind of stuff occurring on cases we've documented, yet it did. So I don't mean to detract from maybe a theory that some people wish to put around this scenario. The reality is it's much, much more complex than I think we all understand at this point.
You know, it's interesting when you mention The Devil in the Details, which is the new book, and you talk about disappearances on various peaks and such with devil in the name or just areas with that. I thought it was very interesting that Corey Fay, of all people, I always remember back when I was young and I was reading books by, I believe it was Brad Steiger, but he was writing something very similar about how there are all sorts of weird things that happen in places. He didn't mention devil, but he just mentioned with weird names. And one of the weird names is Fay, which is the, it is fairy. If you talk about fairy lore and such, the old English name for a fairy was Fay. And he goes, there's all sorts of weird things that happen in Fayetteville. Everywhere you go that has Fay in the name, weird stuff happens there. And here we are talking about Corey Fay, who just happened to disappear under very strange circumstances. And I don't know if that really can count as really a tie-in into Devil in the Details, but I did think that that was very interesting. One last thing here, because we're nearly out of time. If somebody, such as myself, or anybody listening to this right now, is an avid hiker, and they enjoy going out into the national parks, you have mentioned a couple of things in your book that you can do to lower your chances of becoming one of the statistics in your book. There are a couple of simple things to do. What are some of the things people can do to keep safe?
First of all, always hike in pairs. Don't go out alone. Second of all, we've had a lot of people that were hunting and were carrying firearms that have disappeared. Some of them were never found. We have one person out of thousands that disappeared carrying a personal locator beacon. You can get these on Amazon for about $250. Only one person that was just on the outskirts of Yosemite, but we've never had anybody that was carrying a firearm and a personal locator beacon carrying both of them that have disappeared. So I can tell you that every time I go out, I'm carrying my personal locator and I'm carrying a gun. And the people I know, we're all doing that now. And I'm not saying that that's going to save you or that's going to be some deterrent to whatever's happening here. I can only point to facts, and the facts are, as of right now, I don't know of any case that has fallen under that.
So essentially this will increase your odds of not being a statistic, but obviously nothing can be guaranteed.
No, nothing can be guaranteed, unfortunately, but I can tell you that we got to stick to facts, and the facts are the facts.
The facts are in a number of different books, including the one that I have sitting in front of me right now, Missing 411, Western United States and Canada. There is an Eastern edition. There is Missing 411, North America and Beyond. So if you are listening to this from outside of North America, which I know many of you are, that is an option right there, as well as the new Devils in the Details. And I want to give you, David, a chance to let everybody know how they can find out more about these books and yourself.
Well, go to our website, and that's the Can-Am Missing Project, Can-Am Missing, C-A-N as in Nora, A-M, missing.com. And look under current events, and it has all the current cases that we're following anywhere in the world involving people that fit this profile. And then there's other write-ups about other cases and things, and there's links there to buy the books. Don't go to Amazon in the U.S. Those are resellers. We don't sell on Amazon, so they're asking double and triple the price for the books that you could get through us. So, but I appreciate it, Brian. You've done a heck of a job.
Well, I really appreciate it. I know that we were going to – I'd send you, I think, 5 or 6 cases. I think we went over 3. But if you get the books, everybody, we're talking between all of the books, approximately 1,200 different cases. And the more of them you read, the more of these pieces begin to fit together. All of these are not just people, as I said, going out into the woods and falling into an abyss or whatever. I mean, these are all very interesting. We didn't even get into the strangeness of how many people seem to be found wearing only one shoe. It just things like that are just so fascinating to me. But I want to thank you so much for doing the show today. I was very much looking forward to this. And hopefully at some point down the road, we can do another.
It'd be my pleasure.
And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. Hashtag avoid the woods, says Aaron Lee. Pretty creepy show, Brian, he says. This up on the Twitter machine as we speak. What did you think? David Politis talking his Missing 411 series. Had a link up earlier to Amazon.com, but as he noted, go to canammissing.com as opposed to Amazon.com and get the books a lot cheaper. And depending on where you are anywhere in the world, there is a book for you. I've got the West Coast version here, obviously, as a fellow who lives here in Seattle. And obviously, East Coast version as well, international version. The new one, Missing 411, The Devil in the Details. You can check all of those out as well. For the next 30 minutes, we're going to be taking your phone calls. If you want to call in, the phone number toll-free in the U.S. and Canada is 855-478-4478. That is 855-478-4478. If you'd like to send me a tweet, at Brian Alvarez is my Twitter handle. And of course, you can contact me via email as well, brian@wrestlingobserver.com. Make sure you put After Dark in the subject line, and I will read any emails that we might receive this evening. Of course, the lines are open. You are not required to call about Missing 411. You are not required to call about the article that I posted on my Twitter looking at the Patterson-Gimlin film. Although, obviously, if you have any comments on any of this, I would really appreciate the call. If you'd like to talk about anything, as noted, 855-478-4478. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Dave from Wisconsin.
What's up, Dave?
Yeah, just got done with that interview, and that's freaky as all get out, I'll tell you what.
Yeah, you're a guy that's always walking alone at night.
Thankfully, I'm not walking in the wilderness.
That is true. That is true. But you are in Wisconsin. I mean, how rural is the area you're living in?
Like, the area I live in, it's basically like there's town, patch of country road, town, patch of country road. It's pretty much like that. And usually the towns range from like 2,000 to 10,000 people. And then you've got your major cities like Milwaukee, which I was out of tonight. And then I got back here, posting the whole program as opposed to normal. So, yeah, that was honestly, you know, it was a very interesting show. I thought at the end when he was giving advice, he said most of the people are found with their, like, GPS locators and a firearm. So I thought he was going to suggest that you don't carry either of them, which I thought was kind of counterintuitive. But then he just said carry both. So I thought that was good advice. But I'm definitely going to point this interview out to a friend of mine who's a big wilderness guy. He's actually goes out to at least one or two national parks a year. So I'm gonna definitely try and just freak him out with some of this.
Yeah, have him listen to it and let me know if he's heard anything similar.
Oh yeah, definitely. I thought it was really fascinating that the whole keeping it under wraps thing just doesn't seem to make sense. I mean, as opposed to reporting a missing person, you know, the press obviously will get bored of it. Eventually, as there's like no results, but then just like the fact that like the government doesn't keep track of it, I thought that was kind of ridiculous. And I mean, you never really know fully what's happened, but a lot of these just really do need further investigation. So, yeah, I just thought it was a really good interview. Very just unnerving, pretty creepy. So, I'll just let you go for now and wait till the New Japan pay-per-view starts.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for the call. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Oh, hi. This is Sheila. I'm calling from Southern California.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. I was listening to the interview tonight, and it was one of the better interviews I've heard. I always like to hear about David's work, and he's done some pretty deep research, so he's a good source of the information. And I couldn't help but start reminiscing about my childhood and listening to his interview because as a child, I had the opportunity to live in the wilderness every now and then. And I started recalling the bizarre, unexplainable things that would happen from time to time that happens in the wilderness that is, of course, what you have in the national forest. And it seems like there's some sort of tie-in to nature and the earth and some sort of natural phenomenon that happens that we kind of know about, but not really. Maybe we knew long ago in the history of mankind and we've forgotten now. And I started thinking about the lost colony of Roanoke, you know, the whole colony that disappeared, and nobody's ever really solved that mystery. And I was wondering what David would make of that. What do you guys think?
Well, first off, before I get into that, why don't you tell us some of the strange things that you encountered in the woods?
Oh, I'd love to. Thanks for asking. It's really something that even to this day, there are people who are writing books on things that happened 50 years ago. I know I'm dating myself now, but there are people who are writing about werewolf sightings. I spoke a couple of years ago to a woman whose name I can't remember now, but I'm sure as I talk, people who follow this will probably think about who she is. And I had spotted an animal crossing the road in the middle of the night on a mountain that was a huge werewolf. It was the creepiest thing that's ever happened to me because the car I was in was smaller than this creature. And it was about 25 years ago. It was a new interstate, and it was an isolated area. Nobody else was on the freeway. There were two double lanes. It was crazy. I was climbing the mountain, so my car was having to put a lot into the engine. When my headlights illuminated this animal crossing the road, and I contacted this woman because I saw that she was writing about werewolves and interviewing people all across America, and my description fit everybody else's, which is a very tall, long animal. It looks a lot like the werewolf in the film American Werewolf in London, with the long snout and the hump. And she said that hump in the neck, where the neck connects to the back, is always in everybody's sighting, and it had the long paws and the arms that look more like human shoulders. And thankfully, luckily for me, the animal moved into the darkness, crossed the road, and of course now I'm faced with the decision, do I stay put or do I accelerate and try to get past where that animal was because it's in the darkness? I don't know where it is in relationship to my car, but I took off and got out of there. And I'm a pretty brave chick. I'm a little bit badass, having grown up with a dad in the military and having had martial arts training. But that vision of that animal being so large and so close to me, and I felt so vulnerable because I had no weapon whatsoever. If it had come at me, it could have torn my car open like a little tin can, but luckily it went on. The other things that would happen is a young girl.
Actually, before you go any further, you're probably talking about Linda Godfrey.
You're absolutely right. Thank you so much.
Beast of Bray Road, for those of you that want to check that out.
Yes. So I really enjoyed telling her my story, and she told me a little bit about some of the interviews that she had done. It was really, it kind of made me feel at ease to hear that other people had the same fight, because when you're alone and you see something like that, you always look back on it and wonder if you really saw it, you know, because you're kind of told that things like that aren't supposed to exist, but I saw it and it was closer than I would have liked. But when I was younger, as a child, and I spent a lot of time riding horses with my friends in the woods and in places that you really can't get to unless you are on a horseback, and sometimes we'd have to lead our horses and walk. And we would get to areas where we would see footprints, and we weren't just to the kids. Like, you know, if you were from the city and you went to the country, you'd be clueless. We were from long generations of people who've grown up and lived and survived and worked the land in rural areas. And it's completely different than living in the city or even being close to the city. It's almost like being in a magical place, because there's a phenomenon that happens all around you quite consistently. It's unexplainable, and it has for centuries, and there's folklore about it. Then it becomes, as you move closer to the cities and get further away in time from rural areas, you kind of forget about it, and it fades from memory. And I think it's important that we keep reminding people that there are people alive today who have had these experiences. We would go into the woods and we would find bizarre-looking animal footprints. And we would occasionally have a statewide and multi-statewide national level that would turn into hunt for animals that had been spotted that didn't fit any description of a known animal that should live in the area. And a couple of times it was quite curious, because there was an animal that showed up that was slaughtering sheep herds, cattle herds, goats, other livestock. And the bizarre thing about it is that it could move from one area to another, a great distance, hundreds of miles, within just a matter of hours. The footprint would be found on a farm. It would slaughter a bunch of animals. And then 120 to 250 miles away, and 7 hours later, the same animal would be spotted, be the same track. The measurements would always match. Any first samples they would find would always match. So it was, there were mysteries like that of bizarre animals that had these otherworldly abilities to kill and then travel quickly. There would be people who would swear that they were walking in the woods, and then all of a sudden they found themselves in a cave, and they didn't know how they got there. But in the cave were human remains, this Native American relic. And the thing about that whole area on the eastern seaboard in the tri-state area of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, where you have the Seneca Rocks and a lot of national forests that are huge, you hear about the stories that the Native Americans used to tell of that area. And they say this area is considered a holy land. This is where the spirits are very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why we don't live here. We only come here for ceremony, and we don't hunt on this land. So there are areas that the Native Americans knew to respect, and they knew that strange things could happen there, and they used it to get the power, but to be very respectful of it, because that power can turn on you very quickly. But that takes me back again to my thought about the lost colonies of Roanoke pilgrims that disappeared completely and were never found.
Yeah, I want to thank you very much for the call. A lot of stuff there. I want to mention that when she was talking about, there are many places in this country that the Native Americans, they did not go. And as David touched on a little bit, and I did as well, whether it be something with Fay in the name, Fayetteville, or any of these towns, or anything that had a Devil's Peak or a Devil's Mountain or a Devil's Ridge. I mean, these things were given names for a reason. And what that reason was, perhaps there had been strange things happening there for maybe hundreds of years. That's one thing. I actually should have asked her about the footprints, but the Beast of Bray Road, if you want to head up there and read a little bit about werewolf sightings, you're welcome to go up to Amazon.com and check that out. Linda Godfrey, she's been on Coast to Coast AM many times. Might want to check that out. We very briefly touched on it with David Politis, but there was at least one report of a I believe little girl who disappeared, and they later found her, and her claim was that she had been there with the wolf. The wolf had taken care of her. The wolf had fed her. She had been there with the wolf, and of course, when they a wolf is not going to take care of a child like it's its own child. I mean, it's ridiculous, but that is what the child claimed. It was a wolf. Now, was it just an overactive imagination? Was it a different sort of creature that she thought was a wolf? Was it actually a wolf that took care of her? Who knows? But certainly it was a very interesting story and unique, rather unique in the stories that he covers in his books. So make sure you check those out. Andrew here loved the interview on the show. Best radio show ever, he says. Of course, I appreciate that. If you'd like to give us a call, 855-478-4478. That is 855-478-4478. If you want to give us a call about anything we have been discussing tonight or anything that is on your mind, open lines. Had somebody calling in earlier talking about the Zodiac Killer show. Obviously, if you've had any sort of strange things happen to you, we'd love to hear your story. So give us a call if you get a chance. Speaking of dogs, wolves, weird animals here, this from Unknown Country. Unexplained-Mysteries.com. I can't tell you how many times I have screwed up the name of that website. But anyway, two mystery canines have been terrorizing Ontario. A pair of unknown vicious dogs have been attacking people and evading police officers in Ontario. They've been attempting without success to track down the canines, which have been, to date, been connected with several violent incidents. Two women have been reportedly bitten by the dogs. One man said to have fended them off with a rake. Story throughout history. The crazed dog gone mad. To the phones. You're on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Marshall, I'm calling from California.
Marshall, is that right?
Yeah. Well, Marcel.
Marcel, what's going on?
Hey, so right off the bat, just a big fan, Brian. After Dark and, everything you do.
Thank you.
actually pretty excited to be able to talk to you, but I'm actually a skeptic. I sort of listen to the show just for the fun of it.
Sure.
But, I did have a story that it's always bugged me. It happened to me when I was pretty young. I was in middle school, and a friend and I were walking home from school. Now, we took the bus, so it wasn't that far from our house. It was actually just a block away.
Was this California?
Yes, it was in California.
Okay.
So we were walking home one day. It was normal, just screwing around being, rowdy teenagers, whatever. And we turned the corner to go to my house. My house is right across the street from his. It was about three or four houses down from the corner. We got to the corner, and just the strangest thing happened. It suddenly got, and this was, remember, this is California, so, we got sunny weather, 95% of the time. And so it was sunny that day, and we get around the corner, and all of a sudden, it gets really overcast, and actually gets, foggy. And I have talked to my friend about this dozens of times, and he always reiterates the same thing, that, we just suddenly couldn't see more than, 10 feet in the front or behind us. And so we freaked out. You know, we were like, what, you know, the heck is going on? And all of a sudden we hear this loud, just rumble. And we feel it, and I sort of look over at him like, what the heck's going on, you know? And all of a sudden this plane passes over the houses, couldn't be more than like 20 feet above. It just comes right over, and it's the loudest thing I've ever heard. And yeah, it was a big, you know, like passenger airplane. It was huge, and it just rumbled by, and it came over us, and it got really dark, and then it was gone, and suddenly, it, like, the sky cleared up. It wasn't foggy anymore. It was just sunny again, and me and my friend just took off to my house to tell my mom about it, and she, you know, thinks, like, oh, you know, you guys are playing a joke on me or whatever. But we swear to this day, like, that's the true story. Like, that happened to us, and that I've never been able to come up with a real explanation for it. So I thought, you know, it would be interesting to you or, you know, the other listeners.
Well, I got some questions for you. So, A, you've got a witness to this story, your buddy.
Yeah.
I don't want to say this is, like, common, but there have been many stories over the years of situations where people are walking along, and then all of a sudden, like, some sort of weird fog rolls in or whatever, very much like you're talking about. And as they go into the fog, it's like a time slip where all of a sudden they're like, where are we? You know, it seems like a different place. It seems like a different time. They're disoriented, and then, you know, obviously the fog comes through again, and they're back to wherever they were. And so, you know, there have been many stories like this over the years. So I guess my question is, did you ever, like, try to go and look through books and see if maybe, oh my God, this was a B-52 or something from a bygone era?
Yeah. No, I mean, it was really strange because it was, it's hard to say exactly because it's been about 12 years now, or maybe longer, I think. But it's been a long time, so it's hard to remember exactly how things played out. But, you know, I'm still friends with the guy. You know, he's a good lifelong friend of mine, so we've talked about it from time to time. And, I mean, the biggest thing is that we never could find the plane again. Like, after it had passed us, it was like it was just gone. And all we could see of it was the bottom part of it, you know, the belly of the plane, you know, if you will. And like I said, I mean, I am, you know, a skeptic. I don't really believe in any of this stuff, but that's just always been the strangest thing that ever happened to me. But it is funny that you mention about the fog, because that has happened to me before. Within the last few years, like my mom and I we had dropped my brother off at the airport in San Francisco, which is, you know, some miles away from where I live. And we were on our way home, and the GPS was set wrong, so we were heading on a bad path. And we ended up in a place we'd never been in, and all of a sudden we hit this fog. And we were in it for like 10, 15 minutes, and we came out and we're like right by, you know, the ocean after we had been driving in like the other direction for like an hour. Now, that's not that strange because, you know, we were in San Francisco, but, you know, the fog had like just completely thrown us off as to where we were. But, I mean, the thing, you know, with the plane and that was strange because, I mean, we just walked around the corner, the thing hit, plane flew overhead. I mean, it happened so quick, and me and him just ran home after that point. I mean, we... You know, we were just so freaked out, and so, I mean, we were pretty shaken by it for the rest of the day, but yeah, I mean, I couldn't tell you what kind of plane it was, to be, you know, precise or anything like that.
Sure, like, it'd probably be hard because you just saw the underbelly.
Yeah. I mean, all I could tell you was it was a big plane, you know, it wasn't a plane that should have been that low.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
It would be one thing if it were like a crop dusting or something like that, you know, then that would be like, well, I guess, you know, skywriting plane, something like that, you know.
Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for the call. Very interesting story. I always love to hear a skeptic who calls in and they're skeptical about all the stuff we talk about in the program. But shockingly, something happened to them. And as noted, strange things happen in the fog. Perhaps someday we'll do a show on time shifting. You know, one thing, it's not really a paranormal type mystery, but I would like to note that since he was speaking of airplanes, and since this is a favorite story of my wife to follow, this just came out last week. The MH370 captain, this is the Malaysian Airlines flight, which vanished and has yet to be found. One of the latest stories, the captain had plotted a route to a southern Indian Ocean island on his home simulator, which of course would shine a light perhaps on him. The pilot of the missing Malaysian Airlines plane, which disappeared in March with 239 people on board, had plotted a flight path to a remote island far into the southern Indian Ocean, where the search is now focused, investigators have discovered. Pardon me, I just had a coughing fit. The route, which was deleted before MH370 disappeared on March 8th, was made on a home flight simulator machine used for practice by its captain, Zahari Shah. Its discovery has intensified suspicion that he deliberately hijacked his own plane and diverted it from its approved flight path to Beijing. More than 3 months have passed, and I guess the search is now focused on the island far into the southern Indian Ocean. Why did he plot this path there? Why was he going there? Perhaps the mystery will be solved, or perhaps we will never know. And with that, we are running low on time, everybody. It is getting time to wrap up the program. The 4th of July is coming up, everybody. We will not have a new show on the July 4th weekend, but we will be returning the week after. And obviously, with the 4th of July weekend coming, I would like to wish everybody, here in the U.S. at least, a happy Independence Day, a happy weekend to everybody elsewhere around the world. And of course, on July 4th weekend, a lot of you may be out camping. Obviously, I don't want to scare anybody, but since we did have David Politis on the show tonight, remember when hiking to always travel in pairs? Please keep an eye on your children. There are a lot of children that go missing in the national parks, and I didn't really get a chance to ask David about this. But one of the things that he mentions in the book is when someone goes missing, one of his recommendations is often to greatly expand the search area, because sometimes people, particularly children, end up being found far, 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 far away from where they vanished. So far away that it would seem impossible that a child of that age would be able to make that sort of journey. So again, please be safe. If you'd like to check out the books Missing 411, you can head up to the website, afterdarkradioshow.com. We will link up to canammissing.com, all of the Missing 411 series of books. Make sure you check those out. The website, afterdarkradioshow.com. Of course, artbell.com. Head up there. Our Facebook page, facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. My buddy Andrew does an excellent job keeping that updated with the latest stories of this nature every single day up there on Facebook. So check that out. The Dark Matter Radio Network linked up at artbell.com. So much great programming 24/7 on the Dark Matter Radio Network. This show will be replaying throughout the day tomorrow. Brand new programming tomorrow night and every night. So make sure you check that out. I want to thank Keith Rowland, Art Bell, and everybody else. We are out of here, everybody. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again next week. The After Dark Radio Show here on the Dark Matter Radio Network.